her life were spent running a Nazi youth program. Her sons would never forgive her. Her daughter would die of shame. But truly, her memories of those first years are fairly benign. Full of the clean, satisfying feeling of physical labor, the joy of song and dance, and the camaraderie of teamwork. When they are not busy with farm chores, they engage in vigorous exercise. In accordance with Nazi philosophy, Anya and Rainer believe in the civilizing power of sports. What better way for young people to learn persistence, group allegiance, and self-sacrifice? The first lager is in the south, outside Saarbrücken, in a beautiful country estate abandoned by its original owners. Abandoned, Anya will later realize, does not mean anything as lackadaisical as she imagined then. Vacated under duress is probably more accurate. The former owners were Jewish, and the Nuremberg laws now in place. But at the time, she grasps only that the owner was an imprudent debtor who has immigrated to America. Why would she look a gift horse in the mouth? The land around the estate belongs to a handful of prosperous local farmers, descendants of the serfs who originally tilled these same fields. How far Germany has come since those days. Rainer and the boys set off each morning to assist at one farm or another. There is much to do in the late summer and fall, and relatively little in the winter. At night, like the dwarves in the famous fairy tale, they return to the lager, where Anya, their Snow White, has made a wholesome dinner and a pudding for dessert. They eat together at one long table, do their chores, and then assemble for songs, stories, and games. The manor house is beyond beautiful with its grand high-ceilinged rooms, gilt moldings, and painted frescoes of Greek gods and solemn-faced cherubs. When Anya wakes each morning, she can step onto the private balcony off her bedroom and look out over the grounds, the charming overgrown lawn, the orchard with its pretty blossoming trees, the tennis court, imagine, and the impressive vegetable garden she has planted. It is hard work, certainly, but satisfying. She discovers she has a knack for coaxing strawberries from the cold earth and growing lush deep green and red fronds of rhubarb, bumper crops of green beans and peas. In the Forstmann house, she never had a garden. There was only a scrubby plot of potatoes and gooseberries that fell under Frau Richter's charge. The science of growing appeals to Anya, as does the physical labor. Rainer allows her to plan the boys' fitness regimen. She challenges them to compete in hurdle jumping, sprints, even obstacle courses, which she bases on her favorite gymnastics troop exercises. And the boys are sweet and fresh-faced, younger than Anya imagined, only 12 and 13, on the cusp of their teen years. They are dear creatures, excited to be sprung from their homes and cities and from the boring traditional subjects of Latin, arithmetic, literature, and geography. In the evenings, when it's hot, she and Rainer take the boys on the hay wagon to a nearby lake, with cold black water that reflects the hillside and the sky. The boys make a game of swimming to a float and throwing one another off. The biggest, strongest boys are always king. Anya lies on her blanket on the grassy bank and watches their horseplay. Sometimes Rainer swims out and joins their wrestling, his pale, wiry body so different from theirs. More mature and also sharper somehow, harder and more determined, frizzled with fine black hairs. She does not enjoy the physical element of their marriage, but she tolerates it, and Rainer himself is not an avid lover. He turns to her only sometimes, in the darkness, quickly and without preamble. Their lovemaking is over in a moment, and neither of them speak of it. On Saturday nights, Rainer builds a wonderful bonfire and the boys sing and have contests. Who can spring the fastest, jump the farthest, balance the longest on a fallen tree limb? Rainer is in his element here with so many adoring young people looking to him for guidance. In the future, Anya's daughter will send her son to an American summer camp. It's all about archery and soccer and fishing and camping, how to be a good citizen and good friend, how to be a confident young man, she will tell Anya. She will say it in a wry tone that suggests she sees something amusing about this.
But that's beautiful,
Anya will say.
It's like what we did in our lager.
Except they don't teach them to kill Jews at Camp Wekona, her daughter will exclaim. My God, Mother! You can't seriously compare a New England summer camp to a Nazi youth lager.
But we didn't teach them to kill Jews,
Anya will protest mildly.
We didn't even talk about Jews.
Her daughter will stare at her as if she is insane.
But Hitler did,
she will say, as if speaking to a child.
Didn't you hear what he was saying? No, Anya will say, shaking her head. I was too busy, or too stupid.
But this is not exactly true. She was busy, but she was not stupid, and she did listen to Hitler. Though she does not recall what she actually heard, she remembers gathering around the radio in the elegant dining room with murals of pastoral farm scenes painted on the walls. She remembers the boys in their pajamas, exhausted from a day of physical exertion, sprawled across the wood floors, smelling of fresh hay and dust and clean sweat. There was great excitement about listening to the Führer. She remembers his exhortations and energy, his talk of building and unifying the Reich, the unique and wonderful qualities of the German Volk. But she does not remember the ugly quotes her daughter confronts her with. Maybe because at the time what she heard did not seem radical. Listening to the radio at that first Lager in 1936, Anya believes Hitler's assertion that Jews are rich businessmen who have profited from Germany's troubles and taken the best jobs in Germany, and that those who are not rich, which is to say mostly the Eastern Jews who have immigrated here from Poland, Romania, and the Baltic, are freeloaders and Bolsheviks. They are Trotsky followers, the same people who set the Reichstag on fire and created the Bavarian Soviet Republic. Her grasp of the details is vague, but she understands this last group of agitators is dangerous. She accepts this in the abstract, of course. The actual Jews she knows are different. Herr Goldblum, the grocer, or the Kornbluth girls from her grammar school, for example, are neither rich nor Bolshevik. They are kind, ordinary people who happen to belong to a bad group. But how can Hitler know who is a good Jew and who isn't? Easier to evict them all and prevent infiltration. Where they will go, back to Poland, Romania, wherever they came from, America, Israel, Madagascar, is not Anya's concern. In the countryside around the lager, there aren't any Jews. There is only the ghost of Otto Smeltz. In Anya's mind, the boy has fused with the story she told. He has become an uncomfortable hybrid that she would rather not think about. Anya also accepts Hitler's statement that Poles and Slavs and Easterners belong to a lower race, disproportionately represented in civilization's criminal elements. In her training as a youth leader, she learned the science of this. Genetics and brain size and forehead measurements, statistics of their incarceration for stealing and rape and murder. The Völkische Beobachter runs disturbing stories about their poor hygiene and laziness. They breed like rabbits and live on the best, most arable plots of land, much of which, until the last war, belonged to Germany. They need German order, modernity, and management. And Hitler is just the man to bring this to them. Look at what wonders he has done for Germany's crime rate. It is not just unemployment he has fixed. Under his leadership, the country has become a much safer, more peaceful, and more orderly place.
Aren't you alarmed by all the racist talk?
Hitler's rants about the Jewish virus and the noble German. You can't read more than four sentences by the man without knowing he was a racist fanatic, Anya's daughter will press.
I didn't notice,
is all Anya can say.
And it is true,
as outlandish as it sounds. She has never been taught that drawing distinctions between races is dangerous. In Germany, there is no great history of equal rights. For thousands of years, the population was divided into an impoverished and disenfranchised peasant class and wealthy ruling aristocrats. The only teaching that gives her pause is the Christian precept of kindness and tolerance. But the churches themselves are not making much fuss about Hitler's harsh rhetoric. Christianity is superstition, Hitler says, a palliative against life's brutal realities. This is before the war, before the Jewish star badges, before the roundups and mass deportations and extermination camps. And really, Anya is busy with her own life. This lager is where Anya has her babies. First in 1936, sweet Anselm, an easy infant, content to lie in his cradle while she washes and cleans and cooks. Anya has no mother around to teach her how to swaddle and burp him, how to apply salve to his chapped skin to keep it from splitting, how to add pea soup to his bottles to keep him full. So she has to learn these things herself. But she manages. And she takes pride in this. In 1937, Anya gives birth to Wolfgang, who is more difficult. In her heart, she blames him for the downgrade in their quality of life. He is jaundiced at birth and often sick. His stools are thin and endless. She has enough laundry to do without an extra 10 diaper cloths a day. And she has Anselm, who is a toddler now to run after, and all the other boys in the lager. Often she has to let Wolfgang cry himself to sleep. When the boys are 2 and 3, Germany invades Poland. No one wants war. It has been only 21 years since their last one, but Anya believes the stories she reads in the German papers, which call it a war of self-defense. According to the papers, the Poles have made a number of incursions onto German soil, murdering innocent citizens and taking over their radio station in Gliwice. She is an intelligent woman, but she is not a skeptic. It must be true if the paper reports it. Their next lager is also fine. It is 1940. Germany is at war. Most German papers still call it a war of self-defense. As allies of Poland, France and the United Kingdom have declared war on Germany. No one wanted it to come to this. But so far, for the Germans, it has gone swimmingly. This lager is in Luxembourg, which is now a conquered country, rolled over in the rapid and remarkably successful German invasion of France. But conquered is not how she and Rainer and the rest of the Germans they know think of it. Luxembourg has become Luxembourg, and been welcomed into the Reich. Its people have little to complain about. Their casualties amounted to all of 75 when the German army invaded. And now they have the opportunities afforded to citizens of the Reich, including participation in these lagers, as long as they don't speak French. This time, the lager is housed in a modest barracks-like building. It is not as splendid as the one outside Saarbrücken, but it is comfortable. The work is good, life is wholesome, and the war still distant. Suddenly, from Paris, there is an influx of fine things. At Christmas, Rainer gives Anya silk stockings. Where is she supposed to wear these? And also a beautiful sturdy watch. There is goose liver pâté for the boys to taste, and champagne for the adults. Regular food is now rationed more strictly. Eggs and pork and milk are set aside exclusively for the troops. But the lager receives a portion of the food they help produce. Flour, potatoes, barley, fresh fruit in the summer, carrots and beets. It is a shame to be at war, of course. But Anya relishes the order and fullness of her life. They are still in this lager when Germany declares war on Russia in 1941. This is an unsettling turn of events. Anya is not the only one to feel the first grains of doubt. A preventative war, the Nazis call it. Better to attack than be attacked. But the German army is worn out. Anyone can see that it is dangerous for a country to wage war on two fronts. And the Allies have begun bombing in earnest. Air raids are the new measure of urban life. Anya knows Rainer would be called to the front. But even so, the order comes as a shock. She and her boys are to return home. But where is home? Herr Dr. Forzmann is dead. Old Herr Brandt is dead.
Rainer's mother is an invalid, and their lager is to be shut. The following week, Rainer must escort the lager's boys to the train station, and from there he is to report for duty. On the morning he is scheduled to depart, he rolls over and climbs out of bed without even pausing to look at her. He has never exhibited affection for his wife and young sons in front of his charges, and he doesn't change this. "Take care of yourself," he says, nodding. So Anya is left to pack their belongings and find them a new home. Soon, she and the boys are on a train heading toward Dortmund, where her aunt Gudrun has agreed to take them in. The trip is long. The RAF has bombed the tracks, and they sit in the September heat for hours awaiting repairs. 4-year-old Wolfgang is sick with scarlet fever. His body is as hot as a fireplace brick.
"The boy should drink much water,"
an older man says kindly as he passes them on the platform in Frankfurt. He is followed by his wife, who wears a heavy winter coat and clutches a number of suitcases. They are Jews, Anya realizes when she sees their gold stars. The stars are a new requirement, and it is the first time she has seen one. For that matter, it is the first time she has seen a Jew in a long time. She is taken aback by the man's kindness. In the absence of contact, her idea of Jews has unified with the images on the Nazi posters, beak-nosed and nefarious. But this man and his wife look ordinary and sad. She thanks him and thinks suddenly of Otto Schmelz, her one-time friend and partner. Where has he ended up? In Dortmund, life is not as easy as it was on the land. Aunt Gudrun sets her jaw when Wolfgang cries and beats Anselm's knuckles with a ruler when he scuffs his feet, or forgets to say thank you, or accidentally breaks a dish. The bombings come in spates, sometimes every night for a week, then nothing for a month. They become accustomed to the routine of tramping up and down the cellar stairs half asleep. Anselm starts school and Anya and Wolfgang remain at home with Aunt Gudrun's sharp tongue and demonstrative, beleaguered sighs. They eat boiled cabbage and potatoes and sleep under the thin blankets they brought with them from the lager, huddled together for warmth. On Gudrun's crummy people's radio, Goebbels and Hitler proclaim their successes on the Russian front. But on the streets, other stories circulate. The German army is freezing and the battles are bloody. For every Russian they kill, two more spring up in his place. And there are even darker rumors. In the ghettos where the Polish Jews have been sent, people are dying of disease and hunger. The SS and local Poles are killing whole villages of Jews. And the Wehrmacht is shooting Russian prisoners of war, or worse, locking them up in starvation camps. Anya would like to tune in to foreign broadcasts, but she has no radio of her own. And anyway, if she tried, Gudrun would report her. Rainer sends back short, opaque letters. His boots are worn out. They are stuck in some small Russian town or another awaiting orders. A man in his unit comes from nearby Oplerbeck. What he is doing, how he feels, she can only guess. One day, after nearly a year in Dortmund, Anya passes the local Winterhilfswerk, Winter Help headquarters, and notices a sign for blankets, coats, warm clothing, and other necessities. She hesitates. She and her boys are no charity case, after all, until several well-dressed women precede her. Inside, the canteen has been remade into a shop with piles of goods arranged for perusal, carefully sorted by size and type. Warm wool coats and sweaters, feather beds, pillows, and leather boots. Volunteers distribute tickets to those waiting. 2 coats per family, 2 pieces of bedding, shoes for everyone. What a windfall. Thank goodness she has arrived early enough for the best picks. She selects a lovely camel-colored wool coat with silver buttons for Anselm, much finer than any he has ever owned. A thick green wool cape for Gudrun. 2 feather beds and a practical pair of shoes for each. The question of where all this has come from does not even occur to her until she checks out. Redistributed, the volunteer stamps on a paper listing the items Anya has selected. Redistributed from where? Anya asks.
From deportees, the volunteer says curtly.
So these are belongings Jews sent east have left behind. The thought is dismaying. Some little boy had to leave this handsome coat. But then it confirms what the Führer has been saying. The Jews of Germany have made themselves unreasonably rich. Who would leave behind such a coat unless they owned an even better one they could bring along? Bring where is an increasingly uncomfortable concept, though it is still outside the realm of Anya's immediate concern. In the beginning of the war, Anya imagined the resettlement camps to be humble, organized places like her lager,
focused on re-education and run with German efficiency.
Early in her Landjahr training, she received a glowing booklet about a camp for Jews in Poland, a clean, orderly place with a hospital and vocational training programs. The word resettlement conjured an image of a village emptied of its inhabitants, who had been resettled to another village, emptied of its inhabitants, who had also been resettled, and so on, with each population pushing farther into the wide and roomy east, a continent of people shifting to make Lebensraum, living space, for their bursting population. There is an easy logic to it. After all, there are 80 million people living on 500,000 square kilometers in Germany. Anya has memorized Hitler's facts. They need more space, more resources. But now, everyone knows the settlements are really just camps. And the camps are no better than the squalid Jew houses, where the few remaining Jews in German cities have been confined. Last month, when they cleaned up Dortmund, the citizens were told to cover their mouths with cloth, or stay indoors while the soldiers marched the last Jews to the trains. Many years later, in another lifetime, Anya will enter an American second-hand store with her daughter and be overcome with instinctive horror. "Do you know where all these clothes come from?" she will ask. "People who don't need them anymore," her daughter will say with a shrug. "Why do you ask?" When Rainer returns home on leave, he is distant, harder, and more aloof. This is to be expected, of course. How can you fight a war and come back cheerful? Anya knows this. But still, she misses his old jokes, even the ones at which she used to roll her eyes. And she wishes he would offer some affection to his sons. He addresses them with curt formality, sometimes even disdain. One day, when Anselm comes home from school in tears because an older boy has stolen his new pencil, Rainer boxes his ears.
"Don't let yourself be beaten again. You understand?" he says roughly. "The future is not for boys who don't know how to fight."
Anya tries not to mourn the old Rainer, the one who knew how to inspire and instruct with humor, and to bring out the best in young men. They make love, if it can be called that, only a few times. Rainer is rougher and less cautious physically. More than once, Anya bleeds afterward. But this too is to be expected, isn't it, from a soldier on leave? She stifles her revulsion. It will only make her pity herself. In the spring of 1943, Rainer is discharged from service. He has been wounded, and after 3 months in a Danish military hospital, shrapnel is still embedded in his knee. He cannot return to combat duty, so he is given a new assignment, to lead a lager in the Wartengau, a German district of conquered Poland. The boys will be older this time, ages 13 to 17. And the lager will be part of the Wehrbauer soldier-farmer movement used to hold the eastern territories. They are meant to bring modern farming practices to the backward Polish countryside and produce much-needed grain to feed the Reich. They will be at the forefront of Hitler's Blut und Boden plan. Members of a superior race united with superior soil, rich black stuff that slides between your fingers like silk, and ready to defend it if attacked. The assignment has a frightening, warlike ring to it. But then again, so does living in Dortmund. The Ruhr is under constant siege now, and British and American bombs wreak havoc every night. Those people remaining in the city have become mean and desperate. They report one another to the Gestapo for not offering the proper Heil Hitler
or listening to foreign broadcasts, or for defeatist talk.
Our poor soldiers,
Anya says while reading the newspaper one night, and Gudrun gives her a harsh look.
Our brave soldiers,
Gudrun corrects.
You could go to prison for such talk.
The presence of slave laborers has become ubiquitous. Mostly Russian POWs working in the city's coal and munitions plants. Tramping through the streets, they look thin and haunted. A hungry, miserable lot. But in Russia, German POWs receive the same treatment or worse, according to Reiner, Hitler, Goebbels, and every Nazi Kreisleiter. Anya is growing sick of men and their talk, though. In the last year, she has seen groups of female prisoners, too. Pretty and young Polish and Ukrainian girls are hawked at the train station for use as nannies and household help. And a group of malnourished-looking women in striped uniforms walk through the city to the munitions plant each morning. Jews from a temporary labor camp. Their presence has no German analog in Russia. Reiner evidences no joy at the prospect of leading another lager. He wakes screaming almost every night. When the doctor prescribes pills to help him sleep, he takes them right after supper and falls immediately into a sluggish, absent state. So again, it falls to Anya to pack up their small family. They are allowed one bag each, just like the Jews. This gives her pause. In the last year, Anya has heard new horror stories of KZ inmates worked so hard they dropped dead, of women and children shot to death in the woods, of giant ovens where Jews are gassed. She does not believe the worst of these. The Führer who dreamed up Landjahr lagers and one-pot Sunday dinners would never order such unconscionable things. It is one thing to deport the Jews, another to murder them. The stories smack of Allied propaganda, the kind written on the leaflets that the RAF drops. But, all the same, they are unsettling. In the future, when Anya tries to explain this to her daughter, words will fail her. She knew of the horrors and she didn't. She half knew, but there is no word for that. She knew it the way you know something is happening far away in a distant land, something you have no control over. Earthquake refugees living in squalid conditions or victims in a foreign war. But it wasn't a foreign war. It was your war, her daughter will insist.
True,
Anya admits.
But it didn't feel that way.
Until the Vortigo. For life in this new lager, Anya packs warm clothing, a small book of photos, blankets for the boys, nails, a hammer, a wooden spoon, a potato peeler, and her precious paring knife. This winnowing down to the essentials is good practice for the future, though she doesn't know that yet. The lager will be furnished, but these are items you can't count on finding anymore. The trip east is as Spartan as the landscape. The Brants ride in an army transport train, in a car reserved for civilian settlers. Their fellow passengers are a group of young women, members of the BDM, outspreading the domestic culture and hygiene of Germandom to the ignorant peasant peoples of the east. And many ex-soldiers like Reiner, injured men, or those too old for active duty but still capable of farm and police work. She is the only mother with children. Wolfgang is sick for most of the trip. Anselm, at 7, stares out the window, fascinated by the military transports at the stations they pass. He has never seen so many SS men in their long swishing coats and black boots. Anselm is the one to point out the train in Schwerin. A long line of cattle cars stuffed with human beings, their frightened faces visible through the small windows at the top.
Why are those people riding in the animal cars? He asks. There aren't enough civilian cars,
Anya suggests.
The sight is jarring, though.
In Dortmund,
the Jewish transports from France and the Netherlands were overcrowded passenger trains. Apparently, it is not so in the east.
Are there bathrooms in the cars?
Anselm persists.
Where are they going?
Maybe chamber pots,
Anya answers.
To camps in the east.
Enough questions,
Reiner barks. It is one of the few times he speaks.
Look.
Anselm nudges her. He points his chin toward the first car, behind the engine, an open goods wagon with no roof.
In this one, Anya can see the people clearly.
They are standing because it is too crowded to sit. Along the side, a row of faces stare out at hip height.
Children.
With wide eyes, they watch as their train pulls ahead. When the two cars are side by side, Anya finds herself staring into one particular woman's face. She is not old, not young, a mother holding a baby in her arms. For an instant, their eyes connect, and the woman's gaze is so full of despair it takes Anya's breath. Beside her, Wolfgang throws up. In that moment, Anya understands that they are headed to a terrible place.
Chapter 29 The Wartegau, 1943.
The lager in the Wartegau is in a converted slaughterhouse. No matter how many times Anya scrubs the floors, the walls, the wide kitchen table, it stinks of blood. And the boys here are tougher than those at the previous lagers. Some are orphaned. Most are from big industrial cities. They have been sent here to escape the bombing, but also because they exhibit a certain kind of physical and mental promise. They are here to provide labor for the local farms and to seed the East with good German citizens, and also to be hardened into future SS men. This is a new development.
If this is the task, that is my role. And what about Anselm and Wolfgang?
Anya demands during one of her early arguments with Rainer.
You begged me to come along, he says coldly. It was your choice.
But I didn't know what I was choosing.
I told you it would be different,
is Rainer's response. And Anya is blindsided by the truth of this. Her desperation to leave Gudrun's apartment and bomb-besieged Dortmund made her stupid. She should have asked more questions. She will rue her lack of curiosity, her ability to see things only as she wanted to, for the rest of her life. Rainer has been given a handful of new materials, and he shares them with Anya for the first time once they are installed. They are full of fiery quotes from Hitler and the handsome Reich's youth leader, Baldur von Schirach.
Those who want to live, let them fight. And those who do not want to fight in this world of eternal struggle do not deserve to live. He alone who owns the youth owns the future. I want brutal, domineering, fearless, and cruel youth. The free, magnificent beast of prey must again flash from their eyes.
All the friendly rhetoric of togetherness is gone, along with any celebration of a wholesome, simple way of life.
Cruel?
Anya asks Rainer.
Are these boys really supposed to be cruel?
Rainer gives a noncommittal shrug. This new Rainer is stern and silent all the time. Less like a partner and more like an unreliable roommate. At night, he drinks vodka and grows moody and speaks to the boys in a sarcastic snarl. Anya is a little bit afraid of him. As far as she can tell, the lager boys are cruel and domineering already. This is not their first lager. Many have been living in youth homes where they have been sent to escape the bomb-threatened cities for years. In their free time, which is plentiful, they improvise hard games. A ball toss in which the loser is beaten on the back with sticks. A race in which the winner walks on the other boys in his hobnailed work boots. Everything is a contest of strength and power. They beat one another black and blue over who sleeps on the top bunk, who takes the first freezing bath. Who has to muck out the latrine? The same boys always win. When Anya attempts to stop them, Rainer intervenes.
Why? He asks. They will need to be hard.
But they can still be human, can't they? She asks.
This is the first time Rainer slaps her. It comes out of nowhere. He is standing beside her as she washes the dishes, and at first, when his hand arcs toward her face, Anya thinks it is a plate flying out of the sink. She steps back in shock.
Don't talk that way,
he says, as she raises a hand to her bloodied lip. For your own good. There is no more strolling through green wheat fields at dusk singing German folk songs. There are no more Sunday morning hikes and campfire games. There is no more decent heating, clothing, or food. Reiner broods and sulks and spends hours polishing his boots. His face has become set in a bitter expression.
He has no passion left. Not for the ideals that they set out with. Not for Hitler, and certainly not for Anya.
Here in the Vartigau, he doesn't even attempt intercourse. He sleeps in a Spartan room off the boys' dormitory, while Anya shares a room off the kitchen with her sons. One night before he slept her, she knocked on his door, in a combination of loneliness and determination.
"Can I come in?"
she asked, blushing, holding her nightgown at the throat. But when Reiner opened the door, he only looked at her with a kind of weary pity. "It's late for conversation, Anya. Go to bed." Anya's days involve long shuffles through the mud to the post office, where their rations and supplies are delivered. Like a goat, she tows cartons of potatoes, flour, and salt pork in a cart with a shoulder yoke. She keeps Anselm and Wolfgang beside her in the kitchen. Reiner does not approve, but she insists. Her boys are too young to run around with the others, and it isn't only their age that makes them vulnerable. They are softer than the rest. Hitler has not yet weaned them of their mother. She can see that Reiner is embarrassed by this. One day, Anya comes upon a group of boys behind the barn, forcing the smallest, youngest one to swallow live toads.
"Stop it!" she yells, despite Reiner's instructions. "Stop this nonsense! You are not animals!"
They turn their astonished faces toward her. Some are transparently relieved, others challenging. Heiner Maurer, one of the largest and meanest of the group, curls his lip and tips an imaginary cap.
"Of course, gnädige Frau," he says.
But she can hear them restart the game as soon as she is out of sight.
Reiner makes Heiner something like an assistant.
He is as tall as Reiner and broader, from a family of Hamburg dock workers, all of whom died in the bombing. He routinely picks on the small boys, knocking the wash they are carrying to the ground, tripping them as they rise from the table. And he speaks rudely to Anya.
"You are looking fine today, Frau Brandt,"
he says, in the insolent manner of a boy who knows a certain kind of women.
In another life, before the Vartigau, Reiner would have boxed the ears of anyone who spoke like that to his wife.
But the new Reiner pretends he doesn't hear.
The land around the lager is as bad as the place itself. The fields stretch on,
and at this time of year are nothing but kilometers of frozen mud. The village, a cluster of modest thatch-roofed houses, is mostly empty. The simple country folk who built these homes have been resettled farther east, or sent to work as laborers in the Reich. Of the original occupants, only a handful are left.
"How did they choose who would stay?"
she asks Herr Beinecker, a local man turned member of the Nazi Order Police. He scowls at her.
"It was easy," he says. "We eliminated the partisans."
The word has become a sort of catch-all. Communists and Jews and Polish nationalists, and anyone who is not ready to work for the Nazis.
"Are there so many?" Anya asks.
"Almost everyone,"
Herr Beinecke replies. Now she hears that the townspeople were not resettled, but driven into the woods and murdered by local Hilfsverlege, or volunteers, and a traveling SS Einsatzgruppe. The Hilfsverlege are the only locals still alive. To volunteer apparently meant not to die. She learns all this from the youngest boy in the lager, Gerald Eisenblatt, a sweet out-of-place 15-year-old from Essen, whose mother, a widowed seamstress, sent Anya a letter early on.
"Thank you for caring for my son. He is a good boy. I promise he will cause you no trouble. And I appreciate in advance all you will do for him."
Anya could imagine her, poor woman, small like Gerald, wan with worry, her fingers covered with needle pricks. And in her own loneliness, she felt kinship. In an attempt to protect Gerald from the others, Anya invites him to help her in the kitchen as often as she can. He tells her things the boys see around the countryside and hear from the farmers on whose land they work.
And what about the women and children of the partisans?
She asks Geralt, though in her heart she already knows. He glances at her as if to assess what she can handle.
Eliminated, he answers.
Anya does not doubt that he is telling the truth. She can feel the steady crackle of cruelty in the air. It makes her frightened of the locals who still live in the town, and of all the members of the Wehrmacht and SS who pass through. At night she dreams about the dead townspeople whose simple houses and belongings are left. The bucket hanging on the edge of a gate, the single sunflower growing in a small garden, the laundry line stretched between a tree and a window sill.
The Brants have lived at the lager for a year when the orphans come. Little ones, 2 and 3 year olds and 1 infant. They arrive in the back of an SS transport truck, supervised by a young officer who finds it funny to give them swigs of whiskey from his flask. The babies look surprised and spit it out. One of them cannot walk. He is a big, handsome boy who pulls himself around on his bottom, taking everything in with his wide, imperturbable eyes. They are staying only one night. The lager, it turns out, serves as a rendezvous point. Members of the Brown Sisters, a female division of the SS, will come for the babies.
Anya is aghast. Where will they take them? She asks. Orphanages. Foster families.
The SS man shrugs.
The Brown Sisters will decide.
Decide what?
Where they will take them.
Stop with the questions, Anya.
Rhina barks. While she waits, cold spreads up from her gut.
Anya hopes that the Brown Sisters as women will be sympathetic, but she is not optimistic. The BDM girls she has met in the East have been a hard lot. Tough or lonely enough to want to come here and instruct the recalcitrant locals in proper cooking and hand-washing and God knows what else. These BDM women are suspicious of her as the wife of a lager leader, which is unheard of here in the East. And the Brown Sisters are a level up from the BDM women she has met. Anya throws herself into caring for the babies, who are hungry, cold, and wet. The boys of the lager are out assisting a local Wehrbauer as he slaughters his pigs. Anselm and Wolfgang act as her assistants, tearing an old sheet into diaper cloths, mixing a thin gruel to feed the orphans, playing peekaboo. Anya rocks the ornery ones to sleep, swaying gently, humming as she once did with her own sons. The SS men drink vodka and watch. At one point, the youngest soldier stands over a baby lying on a blanket and nudges it with his boot.
For God's sake,
Anya says, snatching it up. And the man laughs. Her favorite is a roly-poly one who looks to be almost 2 but still can't walk. When she lifts him, he reaches his little hand up from time to time to fondle her ear. When Anya turns to smile at him, he looks surprised, as if he thought her ear belonged to someone else. When the Brown Sisters arrive, there are only 2 of them. A meek, moon-faced girl who can't be much older than 18 and says almost nothing, and her superior, who introduces herself as Sister Margareta. She is a short woman with a clipped manner, unmarried and childless, but full of exact information about how to deal with babies, which is, harshly. She makes no remarks about the sweet dimple on this one's chin, or the way another puts his hand to his head. To her, they are clearly cargo to be transported. The cold in Anya's gut turns into panic. Margareta observes the babies and makes notes. She measures their height and weight, the length of their foreheads, the circumferences of their skulls. And she does not allow Anya to help her handle them, preferring the assistance of the SS men, who seem as dismayed by this as Anya is.
Where will you take them?
Anya asks.
Different places,
Margareta answers.
To foster parents.
If they are suitable.
And if they aren't?
Anya tries to ask it casually. She can feel Rainer's eyes telling her to shut up.
That is confidential,
Sister Margareta snaps.
We can keep them,
Anya says. The words come out in a rush.
We can care for them here with the boys until the war ends.
Sister Margareta fixes her with an intent look.
That is impossible, she says, and the idea is inappropriate for a person in your place.
Anya looks down and bites her lip. Let them all be suitable, Anya prays. Please, God, let them all be delivered to kind homes.
She is afraid for the little dark-haired girl. So pretty with her big brown eyes, but not very German-looking.
Sister Margareta spends extra time on her measurements. Anya picks up the chubby one and holds him close. He reaches immediately for her ear. When Margareta has finished her measuring, she announces that she and her assistant will not spend the night. They would like to reach Posen before dark.
So will you take them all?
Anya manages, despite the hard ball in her throat.
She's far, Margareta says, and gestures as if she is speaking about a few cuts of meat.
Already, she and her assistant have taken the first of the babies out to their car, the back of which is filled with metal washtubs lined with blankets, improvised bassinets. In her arms, one of the babies starts to shriek.
Scharfer Meister and Unterscharfer Habermann will take the others.
The others are the roly-poly boy in Anya's arms and the little dark-haired girl.
Where?
Anya asks, above the baby's crying.
Where will you take them?
Her voice is loud and growing hysterical.
Anya.
Rainer puts a hand on her arm. The boy in her arm begins to cry. The younger of the two SS men shrugs.
Helmenung. Unless we take them to the forest and shoot them first.
No.
Anya nearly chokes.
You can't.
Don't frighten the woman,
the older soldier says to his compatriot.
We'll take them to a camp.
When the man reaches for the baby, he clings to Anya, wailing louder. But this makes no difference to the man who peels him from her arms. On Anya's other side, Rainer holds her fast. In the years to come, Anya will remember this as the end of Anya Fortzmann. Not at the moment when she took her sons and stole out into the pre-dawn to disappear into the West. Not in the ruined bomb cellar under the Dresden Hauptbahnhof, when she took the papers from her dead friend's dress. For years, she will sift through this memory of the babies, through the racket of her own tears and the screaming, and Rainer's voice telling her to shush, looking for some lost grain of action. She will try to remember running after the SS man, prying the baby from his arms, or at least attempting this. It doesn't matter that the outcome would have been the same. It would have made a difference to her. But it isn't there. She simply stood and watched and wept. And she let them go. Shortly after the Brown sisters' visit, Rainer receives orders requesting two of his best boys to report for duty at a nearby labor camp. They are shutting it down and moving its prisoners farther west into the Reich. The boys are to assist with the prisoner transport. Rainer selects Heiner, the bully, and Gerald Eisenblatt. But on the morning of their departure, Rainer doesn't come out of his room.
You'll have to do it,
he says when Anya knocks on his door. He is lying in bed, one arm thrown across his face, still in his night clothes. Anya stares at him, appalled.
I won't,
she says. Rainer turns and faces the wall. So Anya, creature of duty and slave to her own fear of punishment, takes them herself. Alter Greiser, the leader of the Wartegau, is known for his harsh response to insubordination, and she has her own sons to think about. She kisses her sons and tells them to stay in their room. Pretend they are sick. And as dawn is breaking, Anya and the two boys set off. A weak gray light illuminates the road through the winter haze. There is always haze here. A dulling white cloud of steam that rises from the manure in the fields and hovers in the air. Heiner sees the journey as an opportunity for unfettered bullying, which he begins by tossing pebbles at Gerald's narrow back.
Stop it! Anya commands. Stop it this instant! But Heiner just laughs.
What will you do? Send me back.
I will tell whoever is to oversee you.
What? That your best and brightest don't follow your orders.
He hoots with delight at his own cleverness, and begins flinging even larger stones at the small boy.
Geralt yelps and turns to hit Heiner with his own stealthily palmed rock.
In an instant, they have fallen into a flailing heap.
Stop! Stop it!
Anya shouts, slapping at Heiner's back. They are on a long stretch of uninhabited road, and her voice sounds like the chirping of an irrelevant bird. She can only stand and stare at them.
Geralt is beyond her help.
By what sleight of hand did her enthusiasm for national service, for shaping young men and building community, turn into this?
You should be ashamed, she says,
speaking equally to herself.
When they stand, Geralt is bleeding.
His lip is split, and he has a black eye. She takes the handkerchief from her pocket, spits on it, and wipes his cuts. They continue the rest of their walk in merciful silence, occasionally interrupted by Heiner's tuneless whistling.
From Geralt she hears a quiet, choked breathing sound.
His face has swollen to a livid purple.
She tries not to think of his mother.
It will be up to Anya to explain his condition to the authorities.
The station at Kutno is packed with people. Since Stalingrad, the Russians have been advancing. The chickens are coming home to roost. Everyone in the East knows it. Never mind what Hitler and Goebbels and Der Stürmer tell them to believe. Here are the first waves of evidence. Wizened grandmothers, bedraggled young women and babies, old men with long faces and an air of desperation, all fleeing before the advancing Russian troops. Anya and the boys are the only ones waiting on this side of the tracks. The camp where they are headed is farther east. Hitler has ordered Germans in the territories to stay put. But meanwhile, Himmler quietly moves their prisoners deeper into the Reich.
Will we take the prisoners west by train?
Geralt asks. Anya has no idea. Truthfully, she has not given the details of their task much thought. Anya has become skilled at not thinking beyond her own sons. It is late afternoon when they arrive. The sky is vast and gray. The station has no name, and there is no town or village anywhere in sight, only a fence surrounding long, low barracks beside a giant quarry. Anya is confused. She has understood the camp to supply labor for an SS farm. But this does not look like a farm. Even Heiner seems cowed. They make their way along the fence toward what appears to be the front gate, flanked on both sides by rudimentary guard booths, from which two SS men emerge.
Halt!
One shouts. Anya and the boys freeze. An eerie silence follows, punctuated by the whirring and hammering of heavy machinery. The men continue their approach. It occurs to Anya that she is expected to speak.
We've come from Lager 428 in the Wartegau, she says. I am delivering trainees.
The older of the two men holds out his hand for the papers. The younger one grins and nicks his chin toward Geralt's swollen face. The man glances up from the papers and eyes Heiner and Geralt, his gaze lingering on the black eye. Then he nods. Apparently, they are in the right place. He gestures for the boys to walk. As they continue toward the gate, they can see the activity on the other side. Prisoners are sorting piles of stones and loading them into wagons bound for a cement works. A group of them pull an impossibly heavy-looking cart. And as Anya watches, something becomes clear. They are all women. Anya stops and stares.
Move along!
The SS man barks, and Anya complies automatically, but she keeps her eyes on the women. As she watches, one of them sinks to her knees, causing confusion down the line. The others continue to pull, even though she is still attached to the rope of her harness. Her body sags forward but cannot completely drop. No one stops, and for a grisly moment she is pulled along, in danger of being run over. Then the accompanying guard lunges forward and slices the rope that holds her, and she tumbles to the ground. The woman behind her manages to kick her body to the side, out of the way of the wheel. Without thinking, Anya stops and covers her mouth.
Na?
The younger guard grins.
Arbeit macht frei.
Anya can make out the words despite his Polish accent. A grim parody of what she once understood them to mean. Work will free you. Re-education through labor. Hitler's promise of redemption through hard work. On the other side of the fence, the fallen woman gets to her knees. Anya's whole body is swept with relief. She is all right. But then, in one motion, the guard smacks her with the butt of his rifle. She falls sideways, this time facing the gate.
Frau Brandt,
the senior SS man says sharply.
Unterscharfuhrer Pretzky will take your boys to their quarters. You will follow me to sign the papers. There is a train due in half an hour that you can take back.
As if underwater, Anya returns her eyes to the boys. These 15-year-olds she has delivered to this hell.
Heil Hitler!
Heiner says loudly and salutes. Gerald, more shakily, follows suit. Anya knows what is required of her, but she cannot move her arm or open her mouth. Their eyes are all on her.
Mach's gut,
she says in something like a whisper, as on the other side, the woman is dragged away. All the way back to the lager, Anya thinks of the boys, of horrible Heiner and kind Gerald, and the fact that she is the one who delivered them to that place. She thinks of Gerald's unwitting mother, in some drab apartment missing her son, and she thinks of Otto Smeltz, the first boy she betrayed. She is no better than those SS men with the babies. All these years, she has been putting one foot before the other, imagining herself a good person, a good mother, someone laboring for a just cause. And she thinks of the woman hanging from the cart, the way she fell, slumped at the waist like a rag doll. When she crawled to her knees and looked out toward Anya, her face was empty, filled only with pain and the most basic remnant of life. But once, it had been the face of a mother or wife, possibly of a sister or an aunt or a best friend. And underneath the layers of time, the face of someone's child. A girl some mother diapered and fed and held. Above Anya. The moon is nearly full and the stars are as bright as always. Cassiopeia? Orion? Arachne? The names of the constellations return to her in her father's voice. They are all in their places. A buffer against the chaos and indifference of the universe. It is what is down here below them in the mud that is all wrong. When Anya arrives at the lager, it is nearly 3 a.m. But she does not crawl into her bed. Propelled by a barely tamped-down horror, she packs her paring knife, a blood sausage, and a loaf of bread. Nothing sentimental, only what they will need to survive. When she is done, she wakes her boys and leads them out into the dawn. Her urgency is so compelling they demand no explanation. And so the night she delivers Heiner and Gerald to their fate becomes the morning Anya and her sons join the flow of displaced persons, severed from themselves. Chapter 30. Frühlinghausen, December 1950. The Frühlinghausen Benita returned to was shockingly unchanged. On the surface, there were amendments, of course. The mental hospital was gone, for example. The building had burned to the ground. And the patients, Benita thought with her new post-war black humor, had probably all been euthanized. There was no more foul-smelling fertilizer pit beside the cannery, and no more dingy Krenzigstrasse. The ancient, mouldering, thatched roofs had proved incendiary when a nearby stretch of train track was bombed. This was no surprise to Benita. For the last half-century, those cottages had been waiting for an opportunity to self-destruct. But Frühlinghausen was still home to the same stupid people Benita had always wanted to escape. The once promising young Nazi mayor had turned into a beefy, middle-aged pig farmer, with green-tinged glasses that made him look sinister. Fearless Fräulein Briebel, one-time leader of Benita's BDM group, was now a middle school teacher. So much for denazification. And the boys who had courted Benita were all either dead or married, running their families' farms or working at the cannery. the stolid red-brick Catholic church Frau Gruber had dragged her children to every Sunday morning, was once again well-attended, its shattered stained-glass window replaced with an ugly pane of wavy